always record episode 123. Easy as 1, 2, 3.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Hey, Tom.
Hi, John. How you going, man?
Good. So this is Kevin. He's a regular member now since you last joined on the show. David isn't here yet. He's reinstalling some software, but he'll be with us sooner than later. So for now, it's just us three. So this is Kevin.
Cool.
Kevin, this is Tom.
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
How you going? All right,
good,
man.
How are you?
I'm doing great. Where are you at, Kevin?
I'm in upstate New York.
Oh, okay.
Right outside of New Paltz.
Cool. Yeah, summertime.
How about
those...
you?
Well, I'm down in Auckland, New Zealand.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, middle of winter, but it's not too bad. We just get rain. It's sort of like Southern California sort of weather here.
Oh, that's cool.
You're still in New Zealand, even though you're traveling about?
Oh, they won't let me out. No, the Crown's got my passports and stuff. Whole other issue, but hopefully I'll be traveling soon. I would have liked to have just been over in London because people I know just launched this International Tribunal for Natural Justice, and they invited me along, but I couldn't make it, so I'm happily here. Yeah, basically been doing a lot of research on CERN.
Good old CERN. So what is your perspective on CERN? I think it's just a useless collider project that isn't going to reveal anything, but what do you see in it?
That was pretty much where I've been for the last 10 years. When I first, I knew about it because CERN's been around a long time. I mean, basically the internet was basically developed to distribute information from CERN. So a lot of the backbone comes from that. They've been running since the 40s, I think, 40s or 50s. So it's a long time project. But I remember when I first moved to New Zealand, there was something on the front page of the New Zealand Herald. This would have been 95, you know, somewhere around there. And it said, "Secrets of Universe to be discovered underground." And I remember actually laughing out loud when I saw that. Because I had just done 10 years at Borderlands, all working on sort of like the etheric forces and Gertian approach to, you know, natural science. And that just, so to me, it's like, these guys are mad. They're underground, like smashing particles together that they create. And then they try to like extrapolate all out, that out here and tell me that this stuff I'm experiencing is reality is made out of the stuff they got down in there in their little smash tubes. In general, I mean, I just think, yeah, they're just a bunch of mad people blowing cash. But lately, I've sort of taken a slightly different bent. I started watching, I saw people posting on Facebook about, oh, you know, they're probably doing demonic rituals down there and stuff. And I thought, well, maybe, maybe not. You never know. But I started posting and started looking at it again in relationship to my thesis on electricity and as a cultural force and how we develop it and how wrong science has gone because of, following along Newton's erroneous sort of patterns of thought. So yeah, I've been taking a real deep look, and it's interesting. I've been looking at, because there was these scientists, Louis Sancho, and I forget his associate, they filed suit in Hawaii against the Department of Energy and some of the other groups that were involved in the CERN, trying to stop it, claiming that they were going to make a black hole that maybe destroy the Earth. Right. And I thought, yeah, okay, I don't even believe in black holes because I'm kind of an electric universe sort of guy.
Yeah.
But still, I thought, well, it's interesting. And Louis made a movie called Strange Matters. It's there's a 2-hour long version on Vimeo, and there's like a 45 minute long one on YouTube. But it's fascinating. He goes back to Galileo and shows that Galileo was actually, I didn't realize this, he was actually the armaments master for Venice. And he did a lot of research on sort of the trajectories of cannonballs and, you know, shooting things out of a tube and seeing how they go and all that. And I start realizing, and this guy's saying that basically these particle accelerators are a direct lineage of this line of thought. And so I started looking into that, and I realized, well, there was this thing, the the academies of Florence and stuff after in Venice, after it was basically in Venice. I'm trying to remember the name of it because I've seen it in different names, and I've been basically doing the research trying to pin down exactly what this was. But there's basically students of Galileo's, the ones that really started the mechanistic science out of this, these Venetian academies of experimentation. And I had come across that data also in my research on man or matter, the Ernst Lehrs's book, who was a student of Rudolf Steiner's. And because he pointed out that they came up with the contra levitatum sort of dictate that it was only gravity, that this sort of higher knowledge of the levitational forces, you know, which basically pull plants out of the ground and things. You know, Newton just saw the apple drop. That's the lesser half of the equation. The higher half is how the tree actually got sucked up out of the ground. So anyway, yeah, started just recently looking into these Venetian academies and trying to understand where in the world they're coming from philosophically. And looking for pictures, there's not too much data on what I was looking for there. But I do see where this whole line of thought has come from. And I've also been looking at cosmological botany, sort of the motions of plants geocentrically and of planets geocentrically and how they interweave into the plant world. That's a fascinating study in itself, kind of a very nascent sort of science, which... if we had $10 billion in 10 years and 2,000 scientists like CERN did, it would be much farther down the road than just trying to find these oddball sort of, or, alternative thinkers that come up with these brilliant epiphanies and try to ground some of it into books and works. So I'm probably rambling a bit, but I think that's sort of the general line of thought I've been taking.
There's definitely a lot of cross-pollination between high energy physics and say something like the atomic bomb. They both provide feedback for one another. And so in so many ways, it really is high energy physics is just a tool of the military industrial complex nowadays. It doesn't really reveal much about reality beyond, it doesn't reveal anything because, well, the predominant paradigm is strings are the new thing and we would need a collider the size of the Earth to reveal strings, and even then we probably wouldn't find them. And we haven't found supersymmetry in all these paradigms that are supposed to extend the standard model. And so it's a waste of time, and that's why I spend my time focusing on these quote-unquote occult sciences, because they're really sciences of the mind and sciences of the human perception system in so many ways, and because reality is fractal and as above so below, by studying ourselves we understand more about the external world. But if we start with the external world and think that that is going to provide much insight into who we are and where we're going, I think that's quite the fallacy. So your not cynicism, well, maybe I'm cynical towards it.
Definitely.
I think it's well-founded.
Yeah, and I'm definitely cynical. Oh, but I appreciate where you're coming from, because really what brought me into the natural sciences basically was in my early years, my studies of both Eastern and Western sort of spiritualism and occultism, and always trying to look for the most primary sort of type and archetype structural forms within these different systems. And this is what I found. Is if you would take a look at the what we call the standard model of physics, because what do we have? It's basically a mandala, right? In the center, you got the Higgs boson. And then around there, you got the four gauge bosons. And then around there, you've got the 12, sort of particles. So you got force in the middle, which is the mandala. Then you got the 12 sort of matter particles. Of course, really only a couple of them really supposedly exist now, because you got all these like strange and charm quarks and all that we're in like the first, couple milliseconds after the Big Bang, allegedly, and they only appear after these high energy collisions again. Because really what you have is like your up and down quark and your electron. And, but nonetheless, they break it down to 12. So if you look at the picture of the standard model, you got the Higgs in the center, it's like center of the mandala, right? if we look at the mandala, that'd be like Virochana, you know, like the all of consciousness. Then you've got the four force carriers around there, which are basically the four forces of the mandala, which I've been sort of interpreting as well in relationship to like Rudolf Steiner's four ethers, you know, in the sort of quaternity approach. And then you've got the 12 stages that make matter. And from there, I go to like Dinsha Gaudiali's spectrochrome, where he basically showed, you know, color is operating in a full circle, pretty much like Goethe did. And there's 12 steps around there, and he shows those as the actual structures of matter. So what I'm finding in this is that the even though these guys are underground, making particles, smashing them, they're total Kantian philosophy-based people, right? You know, that we can never know the truth. All we can do is build up these pictures from the little pieces that we can get. But nonetheless, what they're coming up with is, we could say it's a distortion of these higher occult understandings and structures. So that's what I've been looking at, the relationship between the two. And in that sense, I would look at the, let's just take a plant, like a tree in the ground, right? We got the trunk going up and all the leaves coming out from whatever type of tree. But then you have the roots going down into the ground. And if you look at a picture of root and tree together, you know, you can see it's basically, you turn sideways, you see one going one way, one the other way, and they're obviously functionally different things. One's rooted in the ground, the other is rooted in the mobile active ethers, which you can't see. So if we take this in this sense, what they're doing at CERN is they're taking a couple pieces of root, smashing them together as hard as they can, and trying to figure out how the top of the tree got there. You know, they're just so disoriented. And this brings me back to, I remember years ago when What the Bleep came out. I had this friend of mine who was actually a brilliant researcher doing AI research and radionics and all this different stuff. And he came over to my house all excited. He's going, "Oh, you got to go see this movie, What the Bleep. You know, religion or science and spirituality, it's merged. We've reached this point." Going, yeah. He's going, no, you really got to go see it. I'm going, okay, yeah, sure. Just on your word, I'll go see it. So I went and saw What the Bleep, and I went back and saw my mate Alberto, and he goes, "What do you think?" I go, "Steiner was right." I said, "When mankind gets to the end of his descent into matter, he'll end up with a vacant metaphysics." And that's basically where they're at. If you look at, Bill Tiller, Fred Allen Wolf, all these guys, their philosophies, they're fascinating guys. They're brilliant minds, but there's still some sort of intellectual cap they can't go past because of this deep sort of philosophy of Kant that's been embedded into their system. And I've got a friend who's actually a deep philosopher, brilliant evolutionary biologist. And we have these discussions, and now he's just saying, but that's all metaphysics. You can never really know. I'm going, actually, you can. And I said, because I experience it. I understand how you get past it. He's going, no, you're just imagining that because we can't, because it's all just electrical signals and particles. And I'm going, no, that's the mechanism of experience. You remember that movie 13th Floor?
I know of it. I don't think I've seen it, though, but you'd have to explain the basic premise again.
It was kind of like Dark City. Well, the 13th Floor was one of these movies where the 13th Floor was this big computer thing, and these guys had like this virtual reality. They created this world with these supercomputers that you could actually, you know, you'd go into like a flotation tank or something, and you could actually insert yourself into this world, which was actually functioning. But the people in that world thought it was real, and it's about this one guy going in there and this intrigue between the different worlds. But along the line, just to make it real quick, is in this dream world, this guy tells this guy that, look, you're in a dream world. If you don't believe me, go and check it out. Just get on that road and keep on driving. And when you get in, you'll get to these signs that say stop. He said, keep on going. Don't stop. And they get to the end, and like reality stops, and it's just sort of like computer lines going off, you know, just basic structures. So anyway, they go through it. And then somehow along the line, this guy who works for the computer company on the 13th floor, somehow he gets the idea that there's a higher level in him, and he goes out because he thinks he's in the world like we are. And then he finds out it's sort of a Matrix type thing. And he goes driving out of town and keeps on going, and he realizes, wow, man, he thought he was in the real world, but he's just in another layer of this sort of computer illusion. And in that sense, this is what I see them, quantum physicists, right, where they're saying, you know, they're getting down to the point of where, you know, it's a wave particle, you know, there's this confusion at the edge of reality at this sub micro level. They've basically reached a level like that. Not that they're in a dream world, or, you know, because this is a projection in a sense, but it's very real. You know, I think anybody who's had any sort of psychonautic experiences know that, you know, this reality, there's more to it than is normally perceived in our waking consciousness. But that doesn't mean it's not real, or that there's not some deep spirituality or overarching conscious intent on its, you know, processing of experience.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where these guys seem to think that just because, you know, they only accept what's they can read on a meter, let's call it meter reading science, or, you know, what I think it was Eddington called it, the one-eyed colorblind approach. You know, because basically you can, a colorblind person can understand the science of optics. They can't see the colors, but they can see the numbers that are related supposedly to the colors and understand everything that's happening from that, what we call discursive approach. But see, the discursive approach always leads to agnosticism, because all you accept is that which can be objectified on some sort of secondary equipment, and the experience of the senses are treated as deceptive and not reliable. But this is where Goethe came from, is that he said that he said the senses don't deceive, the judgment deceives, right? So, but the senses can deceive us when we allow them just to run our judgment without processing. And that was why the Steiner tried to bring forth was this whole process of creating the Goethean method of thought, so that you could train to what Goethe called the exact sensorial fantasy, and your ability to actually experience the idea as part of your soul process and interrelationship with reality through both his optical theories and his metamorphoses of plants. So,
no, not to interrupt you, but I tend to think that each order of reality or level of reality should be based on or judged or assessed on its own terms. So to say that quantum mechanics or something creates our reality, well, yes and no. There's a transition point that we have no understanding of. So to say that it creates it is disingenuous or fallacious, because we don't even understand where the transition happens or how it happens or what causes it and so on and so forth. So I think that we, not to compartmentalize these things, but to judge each reality on its own terms. And so our reality for what it is and how our nervous system takes in the signals that are around us, it should be based as some sort of quote unquote objective reality. And there's nothing wrong with that necessarily, and to say that, well, oh, it's all an illusion, quantum mechanics is creating everything, or something deeper, or string theory is creating quantum mechanics, and then what's below string theory? And it's turtles upon turtles upon turtles, and it gets us nowhere. And so we basically discredit our own experience, and then we say that we're an illusion and that everything we do is meaningless and there's no point to self-development. And that's how I see these sorts of things snowballing into a sort of nihilism that I don't care for. And so I appreciate where you're coming from in that sense, for sure. At the same time, I can't help but like quantum mechanics. I just tend to treat it as something that is not necessarily fundamental, because there's always something below it and above it, and there's something above what we experience and something below quantum mechanics. So to say anything is fundamental is fallacious in and of itself. Would you agree with that or disagree?
Well, no, I believe there are fundamentals and they're fundamental archetypes. And that's why the archetypal structure of the standard model actually is like a reflection of what we can call the mandala and some of these other higher structures. So yeah, there is an absolute, but the absolute is not in, let's say, the material of that plane, but more in the archetypal structure which that material takes. So I would say, people say, well, quantum mechanics is just like Eastern philosophies, like Buddhist. I'm going, no, there's actually a slight difference. Because I studied both quantum mechanics and Buddhist philosophy, you know, from like the Vajrayana. Mm-hmm. And thing is the Vajrayana, you see similar sort of archetypal structures, but in the Vajrayana, they're dynamic sort of expressions of higher force. And then the other one, they're just some sort of chance, just happen to fall together that way. And there might be infinite number of universes, and we just happen to be in the one where everything just like fell together just right so we could experience it, but it's just chance, pure chance, right? So yeah, I think, like I say, there are absolutes, but the absolutes aren't necessarily matter. But nonetheless, there's a reason for us being within this realm of matter. And these guys are pushing through the lower boundary. Like you spoke of the string theory. You know, string theory is fascinating in their approach. And what it's almost cliffotic. That's how I think of it. They're looking beneath matter for these roots, you know, whereas the higher forces are actually coming down. So it's almost, you know, they're talking about, well, 11 dimensions, you know, could be the 10 spheres and Dayath. And, you know, the same sort of patterns are there, but everything's got to be inside matter. You know, they can't see as anything being above it. But even, you know, I was looking at like old experiments, like I came across these experiments on, I haven't found it, I just found it sort of brought up in general in this matter on these experiments on Spanish moss. And what they've done is they've done chemical analysis of like Spanish moss. You know, here I got 17% iron, 36% silicic acid, and 1.65% phosphoric acid. And this applies to samples taken from districts where rainwater, the only source from which the plant could extract these substances in physical form, contains at most 1.65% iron, 0.01% silicic acid, and no phosphoric acid at all. Right. And this also ties in then with like Rudolf Hauschka's, the founder of Walla Pharmaceuticals, his experiments with growing sprouts in triple distilled water in hermetically sealed sterile containers. And they would basically measure, you know, they after 3 days, they take them out, weigh them, then they'd autoclave them, do a mineral analysis, and graph it. You know, classic German scientist. I love these guys. And they did that over 12 years. And it's amazing that even though it's the same bunch of seeds they used that whole period, you could actually see the weight would come and go along with the moon. But then as the sun would process around the ecliptic through the year, different minerals would come in at different times of year consistently over the years. So where's this stuff coming from? And, you know, Steiner brings that in his agriculture. He talks about how, you know, like the element to the chemist is the corpse of a cosmic process. And then basically, you know, you get to what's your basic protein structure? You know, is you have your hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, carbon. Again, there's your mandala. And these are actually processes. And Steiner talks too about like the sulfur process being like part of the spiritual process that brings things in and out. And of course, this, if you look at sort of like organic sulfur, like MSM, you know, methyl sulfonyl methane, that's actually, you need that in your system to actually allow, you know, different sort of chemicals and energies and stuff to move in and out of the cell. So basically, from that sort of point of view, all physical matter is the result of higher order spiritual processes forming into physical processes. So everything's a result of that. Consciousness had to come before matter in that, whereas from sort of the scientismic side, we'll call it, they say that, you know, consciousness just arose as a chance. And that's why, you know, because they can't figure it out, you know, and they can't accept past their philosophical impasse that only that which, you know, can be objectified can be accepted as real. You know, that's why they have to come up with these multiple universe theories that, you know, and then like, you know, just so they can explain it mathematically. Oh, it's all chance. You know, there's a chance that it would have happened. And, you know, it's just like, I remember talking to a guy years ago about, you know, the Great Pyramid and all that. He's going, oh, no, they dragged him up there. You know, you saw all these theories, all BS and stuff. I'm going, yeah, but let's look at the size of some of these stones in there, you know, even like the inner ones, you know, for the so-called relieving chambers and things like that. He goes, oh, he says, but you have to understand, you know, they had infinite time to do this. I'm going, yeah, that doesn't explain it. And again, that'll pop us over to like Darwin's thing. You know, Darwin never really showed evolution. In fact, he even kind of questioned it himself. You know, sort of evolution of the favored races, which sort of didn't include the Irish, which was interesting. But he needed extended lengths of time in order for his stuff to work. And very fortunately, his, you know, Darwin was one of the richest people in the world. He owned Wedgwood Pottery and stuff. That's why he could go off on the Beagle and sail the world and do all his studies. You know, not everybody had the opportunity to do that. But fortunately for Darwin, his lawyer was Charles Lyell, who conveniently came out with uniformitarianism, which they needed those long periods for the evolutionary theory. You know, anything can happen over long periods of time. And that's interesting. Derek Ager, the late professor emeritus of geology up at the University of Swansea in Wales, his last book he wrote, The New Catastrophism. I saw that book. I got to read that. Maybe the other following, because he had written a book on the geological column and stuff earlier. He was one of the top experts in, you know, standard sedimentary geology and stuff. But yeah, he's saying in there, and I found out later by reading through things, man, he was absolutely against Velikovsky. Oh, no, it's not that kind of catastrophism. But he admitted in his book that all the geological strata are basically the result of catastrophic processes, not long-term sedimentation. But he actually says in the book that, but obviously there had to have been extensively long periods of non-deposition and erosion to account for evolution. I'm thinking, yeah, that's a rather dogmatic sort of statement to insert in. And of course, we go back to Darwin. I mean, he had two of his cousins. One of his cousins was Thomas Malthus, mm-hmm. you know, the old Malthusian doctrine, and Francis Galton, the father of eugenics. You know, it's kind of interesting how that family and their lawyers and all that were all tied
well,
in with this.
Well, I mean,
it's
even similar to modern day politics where, you know, the Bush dynasty and all these things, they're not necessarily based on merit. It's just that, well, they're all part of the same family. They're all part of the same aristocratic power structure. So, of course, their ideas get play. It's not necessarily that they have any validity.
That's true. But at least those guys back in that day, at least they seemed to have some sort of intellect.
Sure, I'd agree there's more integrity the further back you go. Nowadays, it's more about just money, but or ego.
I'm not even sure it's that. It's more about power. I don't even think they care about money. You know, we go back to, remember when Daddy Bush was running for president when he was still vice president under... what's his name?
Reagan.
Reagan. I'm sorry. Yeah. The guy with the cool hair.
Oh, yeah.
They had him like walking through some store and going to buy some stuff. Look like he's a common man. And he walks up and that was when they first started having those, the bar scanners that actually read the price out loud. Remember?
Yeah.
And they ran the thing past and the thing's reading out the price. And he's like stunned. He's going, wow. I mean, everybody in America had seen those things except like this guy. And it was like he pulled out a wallet. He didn't even know how to handle cash. It was like so unfamiliar to the guy. Like he had never done that in his life because they're in a whole different paradigm than we are. But they obviously – and he seemed to have a bit of a brain, that one, you know, dark as it is. But, I mean, his kids, geez.
Well, I mean, Daddy Bush was part of the CIA since he was in – I don't know, 17 or something, Navy intelligence. And then when he took over the CIA in the 80s or the 70s, everyone was confused. Like, who is this person? Where did he come from? But the truth is he had the long lineage of intelligence operations and a tradition of that. So and even Prescott Bush was a banker to the Nazis. And that opens up all sorts of questions, too. But anyway, go on.
Oh, no, absolutely. And well, the thing was, is, yeah, I mean, because Daddy Bush, not Prescott, but yeah, George Daddy. He was the operations director for the Kennedy hit.
Yeah.
They were used Zapata oil platforms and stuff you know, for like early organization and things. So what Kennedy was trying to do was Kennedy was trying to shut them down, right? Because basically they're supposedly this is I would say the general tendencies in this. You never totally believe it, but I try to at least get a working thesis because obviously there's some nefarious things going on. But supposedly the Bushes were in with the Jesuits, who, of course, pushed Hitler and the Nazis and all that. There seems to be something to that. And Kennedy was with some of the other sort of orders, Dominicans and stuff, that they wanted to basically shut these guys down. And Kennedy did try to shut down the CIA. So what they did is they needed, like, somebody to infiltrate the CIA. So they got this double agent to infiltrate the CIA, and that was Lee Harvey Oswald. But Kennedy was working with Hoover, but Hoover was already compromised by Bush. So, I mean, the whole thing was a setup. So they allowed Kennedy to shut down a couple of the training bases in Florida, you know, for the Bay of Pigs and all that sort of stuff. But that was just, they just didn't tell him everything, because then that's why, you know, they set up Oswald as the patsy on that. But these people of power like that, you know, we go back, they, right, they control the science, they control the money, they control the power, the way the energy goes. And I read this brilliant article years ago on money, power, and modern art. And it was about how these the robber barons and their corporate descendants basically controlled the flow of art. And it's quite interesting is they actually promoted above all the realistic arts, the non-objective arts, which I find fascinating. I mean, I really liked a lot of that early non-objective art, you know, Kandinsky and Klee and Mondrian, you know, just their different sort of approaches to it. Because, you know, there's this sort of thesis that in the development of consciousness, you know, sort of before the Renaissance, you had a more sort of, not so much primitive, I'm trying to think of the right word, but it was unrealistic art, right? There wasn't really perspective, it was more representative of things. And then with the Renaissance, which of course we know now is probably because of the camera obscura, but that's when new colors came in, all the perspective and things like that. They call it the optical phase. And basically, when you got to the Impressionists, that was sort of the end of the optical phase, you know, and that's when you start getting the Cubists and the Surrealists and all that coming in. And that was the beginning of what we can call the synthetic or the spiritual phase. So you look at it from that point of view. In fact, it was an artist by the name of Leopold Servage. He wrote a book called The Glistening Bridge, and that was his thesis in there. And it's a fascinating thesis, but then after I came across that, I came across this article about how the powerful bankers basically manipulated art in that direction. So, I mean, it's almost, you're almost kind of approaching this real complex sort of synchronicity of are these people, are we just like cosmic actors in some play? Because I've got another good friend. I've got some very good friends who are sort of scientific skeptics, and they always like, they call me their tin foil hat friend. I said, yeah, but I wear it at a jaunty angle. And they respect me because I can actually argue them down on a lot of subjects. But they bring up really good points. And one is some of these, I guess they call it retrocausality or something, where they, you know, they can actually measure, you know, they give you some sort of test. You have to make choices on certain things, and they're monitoring your brain. And before you've even had time to get the information and process it and make the choice, choice has already been made in your brain. Have you come across any experiments like that?
Yeah, for sure. It seems to imply that there's some sort of, I don't know if determinism is the word, but there's some order below what we conceive of as normal consciousness, that is, we're making decisions before we think we're making decisions. So I don't buy into that it's necessarily determinism, but it is definitely some other order of consciousness that is processing information and making decisions before we think we're making decisions.
Either that, or when we make decisions, it sends out waves in both directions in time. And we just have to rethink our, it might not be determinism. It might just be that our understanding of time and our place in it is wholly incomplete. But still, I find that fascinating. So yeah, how wrapped up, and I know, I mean, all of us have had experiences, you know, so-called deja vu. I've had quite a number of them through my life. At certain significant points, I'll be doing some, and I'll go, wow, I remember this dream from like 20 years ago. You know, how in the world could I be here in New Zealand in the middle of something here, and I'm experiencing a dream I had in California, like I say, 20-something years ago? And I've always had all these little, but maybe I've had a lot of dreams of things that didn't happen, and it's only certain ones, you know, from all these probabilities. I don't know, but nonetheless, there is some higher order function. And I think we discussed this on a earlier sort of interview. My old friend Vince Gaddis, the great researcher who discovered the Bermuda and named the Bermuda Triangle. And he told me that, I asked him in discussions once, because I rescued him from a nursing home, and he lived with us for about 8 years in California. And I asked him, I said, there's one mystery in the world you could have solved. What would it be? And he's going, he said, two. Can I have two? I go, yeah, you can have two, Vince. What do you want? He says, one, Oak Island. He goes, I want to know what's buried in Oak Island. He goes, man. He goes, and he goes, the second one is a synchronicity. He said, God, because that shows that there's like some sort of higher order function to stuff that, you know, wants to just like, we're not just on some linear sort of escapade keeping up with things, but that there is a higher sort of intertwining mechanism behind things.
And and that's interesting because you brought up Doth before, and Kevin, your chapter in Sync Book 1, if it doesn't focus on Doth necessarily, at least emphasize it at a certain point. And I know that hit me at a certain point in my development and my investigations into quote unquote the ontology of what we're living in. And so Doth itself seems to be an embodiment of the perfect embodiment of what synchronicity means. It's this in-between realm of where the subjective and objective, there's this bleed through. And, you know, whether that's necessarily an organizing function or it's a subjective sort of useful tool for our own experience. I mean, who knows if it's pointing to destiny or not, but Doth. So why don't we just jump off that point, Kevin? Like, how do you view that in the intersection with synchronicity?
I think it's interesting that we were just talking about CERN and stuff like that before too, because I was just thinking about how much this paradigm is invested in materialism and exploiting, you know, the knowledge that we have of this material realm, and thus kind of vivifying the material reality through that science and through the kind of deeper and deeper explorations that we go into the material, and just how, it's certainly fascinating stuff they're doing at CERN, but like what, like you were saying, what's really funny is that they're still focused on how the matter behaves, and they're looking into the mystery of like the first layer, you know? And, it's funny how, you know, these other sciences of a more mystical nature or a more immaterial nature, it becomes up to, you know, kind of mystics and, you know, fringe scientists and artists to kind of start charting a certain kind of territory. And that's like what this synchronicity culture seems to have been doing is kind of documenting its own explorations and its own experiments in synchronicity. And so when it comes to stuff like, you know, Doth and this kind of Doth kind of emphasizes something for me in relation to synchronicity, that Doth meaning knowledge, you know, and it's this kind of sphere that doesn't actually exist, and it is planted between the abyss of the spiritual or the supernal and the, you know, the mundane realities. So the only evidence we have of Doth or this, you know, kind of realm of knowledge that is immaterial is the information that arises out of people's experiences of knowledge and of, you know, intuition and all these things. So Doth becomes this kind of like pool of intuitive data that forms this knowledge that is not material, but there's a certain consistency to it. And so things like synchronicity and things like, you know, quantum mechanics can help paint a picture of what that realm actually is, this immaterial realm where there's a certain kind of archetypal format that people can collectively explore, but it's not something that we can put under a microscope and do. But, you know, as the evidence mounts in all these realms of mysticism and fringe science, you know, that realm becomes more and more kind of clear, and you know, we can see how this invisible sphere is, we can see why it's floating around there, but no one can really put their finger on it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And let me ask you, Kevin, like, why is it invisible? Is it in all fields of Kabbalah, or is it all schools of Kabbalah that Das is included? Or maybe David could even add on to this after the fact, but why is Doth the invisible sphere, and why isn't it part of, I mean, why isn't it an explicit sphere as opposed to the other ones?
You know, I'm not enough of a, you know, deep student of the Kabbalah to know exactly. I can't even think of a particular reference to Doth off the top of my head, but I feel like it has something to do with, generally the kind of lore of man kind of having to create or connect to that, you know, that realm. It's not something that's like a condition that's already present, as like some of the other spheres represent, you know, these kind of universal conditions or principles. But Doth is this kind of like it's always in the process of becoming, but it's not something that is, is at least the understanding I've had of it. But maybe, I don't know if Tom has his own experience of that.
Yeah, well, when you were saying that, I was just trying to visualize, because, yeah, when I was younger, I did read quite a bit into that. And I was thinking, I believe it was actually in Gareth Knight's Practical Guide to Kabbalistic Symbolism, where he spoke of, because if you take Malkuth and bring it back up and put it where Daoth is, right, then the whole design is symmetrical. So supposedly the fall into materiality of Malkuth down below Yesod actually left that sort of emptiness. So that's like this otherness or this vacancy where, you know, the whole in reality where, you know, we actually came from in order to experience. But as far as, yeah, the references, I mean, I think it was probably like Dion Fortune's work. She never even mentions Daoth, you know.
The first stuff I read doesn't exist.
Yeah, it doesn't exist. And a lot of the early stuff I read, it wasn't even there. It wasn't until I kind of got into Kenneth Grant's work and Crowley and stuff. I go, right. Ooh, this looks interesting. This is quite different.
dimension, so. Because when you're looking at Da'at, you're looking at literally the six directions as far as thought is concerned. But it's thought, and so it doesn't necessarily have any real existence. And it's a... that's why it's sometimes referred to as a false crown. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Interrupt anytime, John. But I did do basically about 32, 33 years ago. I did this what I call my Hollow Earth Kabbalah, and I'll have to dig that out. And I'm happy to email it to you because I don't think we can send files on Facebook Messenger anymore. So I have to make sure I get your email, which I probably have. But I actually did a Hollow Earth Kabbalah, you know, where I had basically concentric spheres because I was looking at all the different kind of world models, and I just happened to be reading a lot on the Hollow Earth at the time. And I had this flash of, you know, because the Cliffoth meant shells, so I figured, well, the Cliffoth would be like the reflection inside and the higher forces would be on the outside. And I actually put Daoth as the polar gap. Right, the supposed hole at the poles. That's the only place it fit on that, because that was sort of like I called it the knowledge to interpenetrate all spheres.
You're onto something.
Because Kenneth Grant, he called. In fact, I actually corresponded with Kenneth Grant with this at the time. He was quite fascinated with it, and also I was studying with Michael Bertio, he saw Daoth as the gateway to the back of the tree, which they treated as. You know, the front of the tree was the spheres, but at the back of the tree, the Cliffoth, they didn't really so much as roots, but as lily pads, but you couldn't take the paths because they were twisted and reflected improperly. So you had to leap from sphere to sphere. And that's why they used the symbolism of the frog, or, you know, the voltigeur, as they would call it in their Voodoo Gnostic sort of lingo, to leap. But anyway, yeah, this sort of stuff's coming up from 30, 40 years ago out of my consciousness. It's been a long time since I thought along those lines.
Kenneth Grant has a very non-traditional approach when it comes to understanding the Kleep Boat. He has his own relationship with the thing. Literally, when he discusses like the back of the tree and this and that, the shadow realm, that has its place. But I think it's a little misleading the way it gets represented. So, like, literally, the Kleep Boat are the outside ones, right? They're literally aliens. I mean, that's what they're referred to as. They're alien intelligences that work as influencing on the tree. And so the tree itself, as I'm sure you're aware, is actually the star that's in perfect equilibrium, that's been pulled apart. And out of the gap between the supernal triad and the seven lower spherot that we refer to as Da'at, that's how Babel is erected. In that school of Kenneth Grant, Babylon is represented by the septogram, which is an imperfect structure. So it's as close as to perfection as we can get in terms of building the temple externally, knowing that it is designed to collapse and maintain itself for as long as it's able within the 2,000-year cycle. Have you ever heard that before?
Yeah. No, Grant was definitely non-traditional, and I can't remember all the details. I've sort of phased out of that line of research. The only thing I kept was the model of the four worlds, mm-hmm. which I still completely work with in that sense. No, I can't remember all the exact structures. It's been, but I do remember. I mean, Grant's books are like outside the circles of time, things like that.
Yeah, well, this is as significant as you can get when it comes to the basics of Kabbalah, right? So, like, when you're looking at the Kleep Boat, you're looking at the four worlds being represented as a mirror and getting as close as they can in approximation to the name. They can't express themselves as the name, but they try. So I relate it to, I think I remember this from our last conversation. I feel like Poltergeist is almost the like most optimal metaphor for the thing, because when you look at Carol Ann, if you relate to her as the Shekinah, right, which is the Malkut, which is an exile, you have the beast literally enshrouds her or wants her, right? So they encircle her, but they can't be her. So it's like they want to be the purity. So instead they enshroud the purity and encrust it like a shell. This is related to in Ezekiel's vision, right, when he moves beyond the storm winds. So the storm winds, the layers of them are literally represented as the Kleep Boat in traditional Kabbalistic schools. And so to penetrate the Kleep Boat, to transcend the Kleep Boat, is to release Shekinah from the exile. Does that make sense to you?
It does, and that's fascinating. Fascinating analogy.
And Tom, just FYI, David joined us now, so it's not me. Kabbalah as David is, so I don't want to lay claim to what he's speaking to.
I remember our last conversation. It was incredible. Yeah.
It was not, like I say, I'm like 30 years out of really paying attention to that stuff. And I keep meaning and going back and reading, and actually just recently tracked down a PDF of Gareth Knight's, you know, practical guide. I haven't gotten back into it, but I remember that is probably one of the better books that I've read along the subject as far as my understanding of the basic sort of structures and interrelationships. But I'm not sure he even spoke of Da'at in that one, other than I think as the whole of things falling out. So yeah, I hope to get back into that line of research again someday, and I always appreciate people that know more than me so I can learn something.
Always learning.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm amazed how little I know. I just have some good general ideas.
Well, maybe we can dig in a little bit of Kevin Grant, because Tom, you knew him, and Kevin, I'd be interested in maybe your perspective first on who Kevin Grant was and what he added to
That was like a Freudian slip just then, because you called him Kevin Grant.
Yes, Kevin. A little bit. I don't know if it was sexual. Maybe I'm really into Kevin. I don't realize. as far as that goes, let me just drop that and just focus on what I'm going for. Grant was sort of not the last in the lineage of the OTO, but definitely one of the last strings of the direct lineage of Crowley and what have you. And he's come up from time to time. But Kevin, what is your perspective on him? And then maybe Tom, you can get your perspective on who he was and what you got out of him. So can we start there?
I read the Magic Revival actually really only for the first time like last year, and I was like totally blown away because I'd only read like reference to Grant, you know, little quotes here and there and stuff for years before that. And I was like so amazed with how much his work and his form of like free association, which has gotten some criticism. Like, I think he had like, you know, some loose gematria and loose, you know, Kabbalistic associations that he would make. But I found that really exciting too. But it was weird because I also had been doing that myself on my blog for so long. And I hadn't really taken too much inspiration from occult writers in terms of how I was piecing together ideas and finding these archetypal things, you know, aside from, you know, obviously the syncretic approach in general. But so I was amazed to look at Grant's stuff and just be like, wow, this dude was sinking out on the Dogon and, you know, Sirius. And, you know, he was kind of trying to piece together this this kind of like deep running occult thread of finding a, you know, a unified tradition that has been operating beneath the surface of all these separate orders and lineages and mystical traditions. And I think he really did a great job of at least just proving the validity of such a pursuit, you know. And I think he did unify a lot of Egyptian and, you know, Babylonian and Kabbalistic concepts that I think was a pretty like ripe field of exploration at his time, you know. And so I think he also went a little bit far out, and like in a good way too. I think the occult needed to stretch its boundaries and its wings and start to incorporate new realms of perception, you know, because I mean the models, you know, that came from the mystical traditions are such a production of consciousness, but they also, you know, they have their shelf lives and they start to break down and lose certain relativity to the present human experience, you know? So I think things have to always kind of forge and change. And I think it takes certain people who kind of step outside the mold to see what's what, you know? So I think he did a good job at stretching the boundaries. And I don't know, you know, his perspective on the extraterrestrial intelligence stuff is fascinating. And I think I need to read even more of his work to like give a full opinion about where I think extraterrestrial intelligence fits into the occult, because I mean, the occult recognizes cosmic forces, you know, influencing and interpenetrating all of reality and all of our human doings and stuff. So, we're already always talking about a certain kind of extraterrestrial or like other than Earth, you know, kind of cosmic immaterial force when we're talking about occult stuff. So, you know, I think he played around a lot and had some interesting thoughts, but in the end, I don't think a lot of it crystallized into anything too powerful. But yeah, I don't know. I think he did a lot for the Thelemic mythos, and I think he did a lot for the occult, and you know, even just bringing occultism and forms of archaeological and historic reference together. And, you know, in the end, I think his explorations into the Sirius current and the serpent symbolism and even just in general, what the darker gods represent in terms of an actual more holistic occult consciousness, I think he did a lot of good there. So I'm definitely a fan. I think he did some good and, you know, stretch some boundaries. I'm not like a, you know, a giant, like, I don't ascribe too much to his ideas, but I've definitely explored his tunnels of set concept. And I think there's something to that, you know, that's an interesting contribution, you know.
And was Kenneth Grant sort of, did he do what Israel Gardy did? Was he basically just like Crowley's secretary or?
No.
Well, he was even
he's frustrating to read.
Because, yeah.
Because he doesn't, if you actually like, well, this was my experience with like, I actually torrented a bunch of Kenneth Grant books, some of them quite rare. And I was going through them and I would often try and work out his gematria that he was presenting with my, you know, Hebrew dictionary. And I would see that he would fudge the things. Like a lot of the time, like if he wanted it to fit, he would make it fit. But the irony of like his fascination with the cleat boat is like, that's the nature of the cleat boat. So it's like,
right.
And so I felt like it was a joke. Like I almost felt like it was in you know, because that was what Crowley was you know, classic. Like he would you know, purposefully change what you're supposed to do in certain rituals. Especially there's just even in book four, there's like little things that were purposefully manipulated so that the people would, you know, not. It would force people to go the extra mile to recognize what the actual ritual is and to discover it for themselves, because their discovery would add to its working. And so, like, I wondered if, like, Kenneth Grant was, like, more inspired by that and decided to, like, take that another step or something and just, like, basically, like, identify with the Clipo, literally, like, is what it seemed like. I don't know. He was definitely fascinated by that side of the tree, which is a weird place to put your aspirations because all they do is suck. So, you know what I mean? Like, that's not necessarily the point. The point is to reconcile the tree, not to, like, you know, maintain the temporal empire. You know, it's like, that isn't what it's about. Well, that's what it's about for them.
I think a tough thing.
Oh, go ahead, sorry. Kevin.
No, I was going to say, yeah, I know he was in pretty consistent contact with Crowley and stuff. I think they even met on, like, one occasion. I'm pretty sure he may not have been made it past the grade of neophyte or even probationer. I hate to mess that up, but
really?
I know he didn't really – I'm pretty sure he didn't complete too much grade work. I think he was another person who – who may have, you know, I don't like to speak when I don't know for sure, but I feel like he may have even claimed the grade of Magister Templi, but had not quite any proof nor any, I'm pretty sure there's still no paperwork beyond like his neophyte or probationer or something. So I even get that vibe, and it's like not to try to like down talk it because I think he did some good research, but I get a certain vibe from having flipped through a lot of his work that there wasn't like quite an authority that was cutting through, you know, like a lot of his work was very experimental, explorational, and none of it ever really had to be like held up against certain, you know, I don't know, I guess authority, but like, I don't want to say authority, but just like,
yeah, I hear
it. It never had to like conclude itself, and it never really had to round itself off in terms of like, you know, a conclusive process of, you know, revelation or something, you know. So it's like that, maybe, like, I don't want to say an aimlessness, but I felt like his work just kind of is this sum of material, but none of it really ever like tied together, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's fascinating insight, Kevin. I don't know too much about his grade work. I know he presented himself as 10th degree, which is actually administrative degree. I do know, I mean, when he was young, he used to like go and score like Crowley's heroin for him and stuff like that, from what I had heard from various stories. And it's interesting what you had said about the grade work and his the probability that he didn't do it. I mean, because, you know, he was also good mates with Austin Osmond Spare. And of course, became his literary executor when Austin died. But, you know, Grant's whole thing was he got rid of the grade structure in a general sense and went to the Kaula circles and brought in sort of like the Eastern Tantras. And, yeah, which is kind of almost like going back to the old sort of Gnostic circles, the way it was, you know, that there was really no head, that they might pick, a priest and priestess to officiate each ceremony when they'd get together, but there was no real hierarchy there because, so yeah, I don't really know too much about that particular side, but I corresponded with him probably for about 5 or 6 years. And unfortunately, my collection of letters and correspondence with him got destroyed in some storm damage in a shed in California. And I really regretted losing all those letters because they were absolutely fascinating. And I discussed quite a bit of stuff with him along those lines, because I had sort of what we call dream contacts, higher order contacts with what I call my holy guardian angel, called Atam, Aleph Tau, Tau Aleph Yod Mem, which was like a Kabbalistic formula for the formation of reality in the way I had seen it. But I didn't want anybody to like know about that, so I asked Kenneth not to. So I'm actually mentioned in a couple of his books in regards to some of the Borderland work, but none of that stuff ever made it into print because I asked him not to. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, oh man, I should have let him roll with it, because then there would have been like a record of it out there, because it was some pretty fascinating stuff. But you're right, Dave. I mean, yeah, he was, because I'd ask him, I'd try to work out some of that Kabbalistic stuff, because I had all these different Kabbalistic systems and tried to work it all out. And I'd ask him, I go, well, what's up with that? He'd go, no, just, he wouldn't give me a straight answer. He goes, oh, it's just standard gematria, but I couldn't figure it out from that. But I'll say one thing about him, man. He was a very fine and scholarly gentleman, man. He would respond to every letter, answer your questions. He was just...
would you say he had a good sense of humor, sir?
He had a dry sense of humor. Yeah, he was. Mm. It was witty and dry. He, you know, wasn't like overtly funny, but it was sort of like that British sort of, you know, you just sort of like appreciate the things he said. They were cutting in there. But I met, I met him through Michael Burdio, because I had read books like Cults of the Shadow, and I'm reading about this guy Michael Burdio, and I found out he lived in Chicago. And I found this old Chicago occult magazine and had an address for him. I go, far out. I went and looked, but his name wasn't on the list of the apartment building. I thought, God, I'd love to meet this guy. And then there was an old bookstore in Chicago called the Occult Bookstore. That was his actual name on North State Street, run by this brilliant old guy named Russell Thorne. And he was the first guy that actually turned me on to the Kabbalah, just in there looking around. I was looking for books on witchcraft and stuff. I was probably about 12 or 13 or something. He's going, oh, why don't you read the Kabbalah? I'm going, what's that? And he starts talking about Ain and Ain Sof Or and looking at the ceiling. I'm going, I want to find out what this guy's on.
Right.
But anyway, then I pretty much came across Grant's work and started doing that. And somewhere along the line, because I used to do these sort of lectures, which I didn't make too many of in the earlier days. But then I used to do a thing called the Emergency Theater, which is kind of like surrealistic sort of plays and stuff. And it was quite fascinating stuff. And Burdio was, well, the first one, he was giving a talk on Austin Spare. I thought, oh, far out. I get to meet Burdio and get a lecture on Spare. And I have to admit, I was disappointed with his interpretation of Spare's work. I thought I had a better understanding of it than he did. But it was kind of cool to meet him. And then a couple months later, he did a series of four on basically extraterrestrial Gnosticism and time flows. And it was actually, I still have my notes from those lectures. Really fascinating stuff. And he discussed like the Pleroma of the Aeons and how there's these different timelines coming off and how you could build your temples to radionically connect them. And not only you could go forward and backward in time, but you could go sideways into these alternative realities. And anyway, so I started chatting with Michael and, you know, because I'd read, you read Grant's books, you know, you got to go through like the Monastery of the Seven Rays and do your 4-year study. And then, you know, if you pass the grades, then, you know, then you can get into one of his, you know, La Couleuvre Noir, La Couleuvre Rouge or whatever, and do all that. So anyway, I meet the guy chatting to him at this lecture. I'm kind of cordially met him at the first time. I think I was just intimidated by what I thought was his greatness first time. So I just sort of said hi and split. The second time, you know, I was kind of discussing with him the content of his lecture, because I had been basically studying Gnosticism at the time, you know, through like Hans Jonas's work and, the woman that wrote Elaine Pagels and stuff, things like that. Not really in great depth of understanding, but at least I was trying to figure out what was there. Mm-hmm. And we were having a conversation for like 10 minutes. He said, well, how'd you like to be my personal student? I go, yeah. I said, well, I haven't done like that Monastery Seven Rays. He goes, ah, don't worry about that stuff, man. He goes, you know what you're talking about. So anyway, so I start talking to him, and he gave me Kenneth Grant. He said, well, you want to correspond with Kenneth Grant? He'll understand what you're talking about. And that was how I got onto Kenneth Grant. And yeah, Michael wanted me to, because he was running Ordo Templi Orientis Enchiente, as well as the Karamzin Club, and you know, it was like Monastery of Seven Rays. He had all these different things going, and he had Nigerian like Gnostic priests coming. I met this fascinating guy, Reverend James Sunday Fasuyi, came over from Nigeria. I kind of toured him around Chicago and stuff, and he was telling me, like, you know, they were into Ifa, and he was telling me that when he was initiated, that his teachers actually took bags of herbs and crystals and pushed him inside his body, and they're actually in his abdomen and stuff. And he said there was this time that he had to go to America, and there was going to be this big crisis in the future, and that he was going to be needed, and he's going to be able to pull these things out of his body and use them to like help people at the time. And I was thinking, far out. You really meet some far out people.
There's actually an old story about that. That's a classic Kabbalistic story with the 42 jewels in the person's body. I forget the specifics around it.
And one of my favorite movies is Fifth Element, and the opera singer, who's a blue woman, has the four elements basically in her belly, and mm-hmm. Bruce Willis pulls them out of there.
Dig it.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.